KPCW News time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. We got snow. We got an accident. There's an accident on I-80 eastbound heading towards Summit Park around Parley's as usual, but the looks like it's creating some real backup. The left lane and the left shoulder are blocked, and traffic is starting to build up behind it. As I mentioned, we're having some snow. Cedric Haynes has brought us this beautiful spring weather for the Easter weekend. Cedric, what else have you got cooked up for us?
Well, you know, I think you will love what I have coming up as we get towards the end of the weekend, especially for our Saturday and Sunday. But before we get there, we've got to get through today. And as you mentioned, we've got those snow showers that are out there, and we'll likely see off and on snow showers continuing throughout the day. So, yeah, the spring-like weather we saw earlier this week is definitely a distant memory now with these temperatures that are about 15 to 25 degrees colder than yesterday morning at this time. So a big change out there. We'll see these snow showers continuing off and on, but accumulations are going to remain fairly light. So we could pick up about a half an inch to an inch on some of the grassy surfaces there as you get into the Heber Valley, maybe picking up about 1 to 3 inches there around the Park City area. But overall, nothing that we can't handle too much. And with the warm temperatures we've recently had, most of the actual roadways and pavements will just be primarily on the wet side. So that's the good news. Then, as we go into the weekend, this is where we get to bring you the good news here, as Saturday is going to feature some nice weather with lots of sunshine returning across the area. I do want to warn you, though, our Saturday morning will start off on the frigid side, as Park City and Heber Valley will both be looking at morning low temperatures right around 20 degrees. So it's going to be quite the shock there, as some pretty cold air will be with us to kick off the day early in the morning. But with that sunshine, the good news is we do rebound quite nicely. So we'll see highs climbing into the mid-40s there in the Park City area for your Saturday afternoon, and high temperatures in the Heber Valley will climb into the low to mid-50s. So a big change, but we've just got to get through about the next 24 hours of frigid temperatures and snow shower activity, and then we'll be back to spring-like weather by your Saturday afternoon. As we go into your Sunday, upper 20s to kick off the day in the Heber Valley. We'll start the day around 30 degrees there in Park City with partly cloudy skies, and we'll see our daytime highs topping out into the 50s in Park City on Sunday, and high temperatures will climb back into the low 60s on Sunday in the Heber Valley. As we get beyond that into the beginning of next week, we've got a couple of weak storm systems that are going to kind of graze the northern half of the state. So we could see a couple of isolated showers as we go into your Monday. High temperatures will be into the mid-50s there in Park City, and highs will be back into the low 60s in the Heber Valley. As we go into your Tuesday, we dry it out with partly cloudy skies. How about highs in the mid to upper 50s in Park City and mid-60s returning into the Heber Valley? So, guys, we just got to get through the next 24 hours, which is definitely not going to be spring-like.
All right, Cedric. Thanks very much, and have a great holiday weekend.
You too. Thank you so much.
Coming up, I'll be joined by Greg Maughan of the South Summit School District. He's the superintendent with an update on what's going on in South Summit. Then Noah Hogg of the Mount Orford Ski Area will call in and tell us about their shot ski event. We'll finish our hour by speaking with Kathy Donnell of the Wasatch Mountain State Park. She's a naturalist there, about their upcoming Dark Sky Celebration and other events coming up this spring. Stay tuned. But then following this show on the Community Campfire, take a fun and colorful dive into two of Midway Elementary's most beloved icons, Miss Sally and the legendary two-headed calf. Then vibe out with a campfire music session featuring indie pop artist Aspen Ananda, serving up soulful songs and heartfelt stories, plus campfire kids, fun Friday facts, and a spark or two of surprise. The Community Campfire, Your Stories, Your Voice, is coming up right after this program, only here on KPCW. Well, a Summit County planning official has been tapped to head the new County Housing Authority. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more on this new county agency.
County Planner Madeline McDonough will be the Economic Development and Housing Manager, reporting to Department Director Jeff Jones. The new position doubles as the Executive Director of the new Summit County Housing Authority, which will be tasked with making housing affordable and available locally. Here's Jones.
And I think everyone that knows Maddie is going to really be impressed with her ability to see projects through to the end. By background, in addition to be a land use planner, she's also a former teacher. So she's really good at explaining things. And I couldn't be happier that she's joining our department.
While with the planning department, McDonough oversaw the countywide visioning process called Our Summit. It's informing parallel general plan revisions underway on the east side and in the Snyderville Basin. She also worked on a rail trail master plan that recommended improvements to the path from Park City to Colville, Both efforts won recognition from the American Planning Association. McDonough also runs the Community Planning Lab, where residents learn about planning principles, a feeder to local planning commissions. She topped the field of 9 applicants, according to Jones, and will start April 21st. The rest of the Housing Authority is taking shape, too. The Summit County Council will interview residents for 2 at-large seats on the 5-member board April 23rd. Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW, and I'm Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
The height of wildfire season is fast approaching as Utah's snowpack melts earlier than normal this year. KPCW's Christine Weller reports on what Wasatchback residents can do to prepare and protect their homes.
The Utah Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands says the wildfire season may start earlier this year. Utah's snow is melting earlier than normal, meaning grasses and brush, fuel for fires, will dry out earlier. The Forestry Division's Kaylee Guild said monsoonal moisture will likely pass through the state in July, but that also brings risks.
It's kind of a double-edged sword, though, too, if you look at it. Monsoons bring, it brings rain, but with rain, it typically brings lightning.
Guild said wildfire danger is highest in Utah from April to November, though wildfires can spark any time of year. For example, the 2024 Yellow Lake Fire in Wasatch County sparked in September and burned for over a month. The blaze consumed more than 33,000 acres in the Uinta Mountains and was the highest priority fire in the U.S. at one point. Though the Yellow Lake Fire was significant, Guild said 2024 was not an extreme wildfire year.
Compared to more of the severe wildfire seasons like 2020, I also recall 2012 was another significant year. 24 was less extreme, but it was still a wake-up call for folks within the wildland-urban interface areas to kind of do their part and to work on mitigation efforts around their homes.
The wildland-urban interface is the area where undeveloped land meets human development. Gillett said people who live in these areas, which include much of the Wasatch Back, must prepare their homes for wildfires. That includes cleaning out gutters, mowing grass, and trimming tree limbs so at least 30 feet around homes are free of flammable materials. Guild said anyone with plans to build should consider fire-resistant materials as well. Another consideration for Wasatch Back residents, especially those who live near the Yellow Lake Fire, is flash flooding. Guild said that's because fires leave burn scars.
Even from just a light rain, what happens is the soil actually, it kind of deflects. It doesn't absorb in after a fire comes through the area. And so what happens is mudslides and debris flows and erosion can take place and damage property and roads.
Guild recommended Wasatch Back residents sign up for weather and flood alerts. More information about fire safety can be found on the Utah Fire Info website. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, the South Summit School Board held its regular meeting last night. On the phone with an update is Superintendent Greg Mong. Morning, Greg.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. I'm enjoying this fantastic spring weather.
Oh, isn't it beautiful?
Well, Greg, I understand you guys had a work session about a feasibility study on new school sites. Can you explain a little bit about what that's about and what you guys are looking at?
Sure. So this last Monday, we had a board work session where we talked about facilities, obviously, and you know, we've been talking about facilities for quite some time, and the issue of our buildings and the age that they're getting to be, and you know, there's a lot of factors that go into determining you know, just how well the buildings are faring, you know, as far as maintenance and costs that have to go into keeping them up and that. And so anyway, we've been looking at that for quite some time. And so the board had a work session to look at potential, you know, well, a 20-year master plan, basically, mm-hmm. to look at, you know, building schools, what would we build first kind of thing, and where would we consider building. We also talked about, we've already had a feasibility study done on moving our transportation department. And so that was part of the conversation as well. That's been a conversation for a few months. And so really it was a great time to get together and look at the different properties and, consider what would go best in which location, and it just kind of the ins and outs of why certain properties would work better than others, potentially. So
I guess part of this exercise, Greg, is trying to decide whether you expect your population to grow, whether you would need more buildings. And part of it is looking at how long your old buildings are going to last. With respect to the first question, are you guys looking for the possibility of increased enrollment, or do you expect it to be reasonably stable for the next 10 to 20?
Well, you know, who knows, but you
got to guess.
We do. And you know, the last time we did a study, we anticipated, you know, it was before my time, but there was an anticipation that enrollment would go up significantly, and that hasn't happened. And I think some of that is just the realities that we face of the cost of housing in Summit County in general. But our buildings are getting old, and so it isn't necessarily that we would be adding buildings, but potentially, you know, just with the need to replace because of the age and condition of buildings as they age, the need to build so that we've got up to date and you know, with as far as safety and just providing the best academic spaces that we can. So that's really what we'd be looking at. Some of those conversations have been around building, you know, over the course of a 20-25 year span, doing a K-6 school and then a 7-12 school as opposed to three separate buildings, just trying to be fiscally responsible, you know, to our community.
You know, that's interesting. I sometimes wonder whether school buildings are kind of like old pickup trucks. You can refurbish them a few times, but at some point you get to the point where either the performance can't be maintained or the technology has changed enough that the old building doesn't really do what you want it to do for modern education. Are you guys looking at a little of both of those?
Yeah, we are. And I think, you know, as far as the discussions that we've had, I think, obviously we're gonna have a feasibility study done, but I think we'd be looking at starting with the elementary model and doing something with a K-6 and starting there.
Okay. You reported the board about your meeting with MTEC about a potential partnership. This will probably hopefully lead us into a broader conversation about the range of vocational education. But first, can you explain to the audience what MTEC is?
Yeah, so we're part of a consortium with Mountainland Technical College. We are, like I said, part of a consortium, and it's made up of several districts. MTEC is what we call that technical college, Mountainland. So we had the MTEC president and the vice president of facilities come out and visit this week. And we were able to take them around and show them some of the properties that we have to look at a partnership similar to what other school districts have been able to do with MTEC. So really what that would be would, if that's something that happens, it would put it would really build a robust certification program in several areas that would be a huge benefit to us and our students, obviously, but then also a huge benefit to our community with offering certification programs to adults as well, just as most technical colleges do.
So taking it down a level, would this consist of having them come into your buildings to provide technical education or sending students and adults to their buildings or both?
No, generally they have and own their own buildings. They do prefer to have those close to high schools because there should be a benefit to those in the consortium. And so it would be buildings, it would require them to either build a building or purchase an existing building. You know, do whatever they'd need to do to retrofit to meet their needs, and go from there.
So this really would be a long-term deal, right? In order for it to come to fruition, if they would have to.
It's something similar. Wasatch recently, they had partnered with MTEC, and so it was something that it took a few years to come to fruition, but that building is currently under construction, and so it's one of those things where even if it's a 3 or 4 or 5 year deal, if you don't start, you don't ever get to the finish line. So we really are trying to look at not just a short term, but a long term benefit to students and to our community.
As I said at the beginning, it sort of goes into a broader discussion of the kinds of education that we need to provide to our modern students. Talk a little bit about some of the technical areas that MTEC, the kind of programs that you might envision of them providing to your students.
Well, MTEC has all kinds of options and opportunities at their different locations. There's auto mechanics, diesel mechanic. There's all kinds of different certification programs in information technology and information systems. They have a really robust nursing program, construction, and all of the different components of construction. I think when we met earlier this week, I think one of the we were talking about, they had 140 or 150 people on a wait list just for the electrical program.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting in our conversation, we talked about how many kids nowadays, when they graduate high school, some of them have never actually swung a hammer and hit a nail to build anything. It's just the reality is, we do want kids to get post-secondary education, but that doesn't necessarily mean a college or university route.
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge need for the trades, and so that's part of our responsibility to help prepare students for life outside of beyond high school as well, and so. Any of those programs certainly could be a focus that would be part of the feasibility study. But mm-hmm. I anticipate we have some strong programs at our high schools currently, and I think we would try to build on those as well. Some of the nursing, some of the welding, things like that.
So would this augment some of your existing relationships with UVU, for example?
Well, so it's funny, the reason I'm calling in instead of sitting there with you is because I had to step out of a meeting. We're part of a K-16 alliance, and MTEC is part of that, and along with UVU. And so UVU is at the table as well in these conversations that we have. It really would be between MTEC and South Summit School District and the other districts in the consortium, but. I don't see it having any negative impact with our UVU connection because a lot of our technical programs that are getting concurrent enrollment are happening through MTEC already and UVU.
Well, I think that's pretty exciting and an important function.
Yeah.
Okay, Greg, it's springtime, notwithstanding what's going on outside. We're getting near the end of the year. I guess next month I'm going to ask you about where your senior class is going because I'm sure you're still learning about that. But this month I wanted to ask you about the fact that you guys had looks like you got a pretty nice crop of Sterling Scholars this year. You want to brag a little bit?
Oh, I love getting to brag. Yeah, we had a lot of our students. We had a great showing for South Summit School District. Several kids placing, as runners up or as winner. We couldn't be more proud of our students. We couldn't be more proud of their advisor and of their teachers helping prepare them. Our board asked last night those that came to be. Acknowledged, our board members asked, are there things we could do to make it even better? And it was nice to hear the students couldn't think of anything right there off the top of their head of how we could improve preparing kids for Sterling Scholar. They feel like we've got a good thing going, and we really do. It's a testament to the fact that it's the people that make the difference, not a program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and having the right people doing the right job makes all the difference in the world. And when you connect the right kids with the right adults, you know, the magic really happens.
Well, because I...
It's great.
Greg, I suspect you don't have the list in front of you. I'm going to read it for you. Here are the list of winners and runners-up. Anna Pernicard, Ashlyn Atkinson, Branson Halliday, Briggs Metcalf, Camden Cox, Damon Milbourne, Hunter Bednarik, Ivy Jackson, Mariah Bowen, Sienna Sargent. Quite a list, Greg.
Yeah. They're amazing students. It's one of those things you sit there and you think... When I was at UVU at the banquet and awards night that night, you think, man, you know, with all of the negative that we hear in the media and see on TV and that, to get to spend a night with amazing kids, you just think, okay, things are going to be okay. They're going to work out. It'll be fine because these are great people and what bright futures they have. And what a great hope it gives me as I get to rub shoulders with these kids and not just from South Summit. You know, that night was from our whole region, and we're fortunate in our region and in our district to have such amazing students.
And that seems like a good note to end. Next month, I'm going to ask you where some of them are going. Thanks, Greg.
Great.
All right.
You bet. Thank you.
We'll be right back after this. Well, for years, the record for the biggest Shotski event has ping-ponged between Park City and Breckenridge. But a few days ago, a new factor came sweeping down from the north. Here to talk about it is Noah Hogg of the Mount Orford Ski Area. Noah, thanks for joining us this morning.
Hey, Mr. Goldman, how are you?
I'm doing great. So, Noah, before we get to the Shotski event that you guys have now taken the record in, can you share a bit about the Mount Orford Ski Area?
Yes, of course. So we're in the Eastern Townships, so just north of the border of the U.S. In Quebec, Canada, about half an hour from Vermont. We got some great ski this winter, got lucky with the snow. Season's still going on. We got our last weekend with Easter weekend right now. Got a lot of people, sun's out. Everything is going really good.
But how many lifts do you have and how much vertical?
So we got five lifts overall. Vertical, I'm going to try to convert it in feet.
We'll take it in meters. It's okay.
In meters, around 800 meters.
Okay. And so how big a town do you have?
Around 25,000 people.
So the reason I ask you all these questions is to give our listeners a sense that this is, you know, not a gigantic ski area. What inspired you to stage a Shotski event?
So we're not a big ski area in terms of population, but we're a big ski area in terms of just a lot of people who love the outdoors, love the ski, love the hike. It's just a great community for outdoors in general. We got four mountains in our region for not a lot of population, so it attracts a lot of people from a bit everywhere. Montreal is our biggest city in Quebec, around 1 million people, so we get a lot of people from that city as well who come down to ski. And we just saw the fun event between Utah and Colorado, just the fun back and forth going around, and we thought it would be a great idea to just link the two communities, east and west, north and south, to just have a bit of fun and just bring those two communities together and just have a bit of fun with it, see if you guys would let us hop in and bring us along on the ride.
Okay. Somehow I suspect you're going to get a response, but let's stick with this. When was the event held and when was the event held?
So 2 weeks ago on the 29th of March, that's when it was held. Initially, we wanted to bring it early in the winter just to have it initiate our whole winter and have a cheers to hoping to have a lot of snow and all of that. We realized it's a lot harder and a lot more complicated to organize than just a small beginning of the year event. So we decided to postpone it more to the end of the year. We also have our big après-ski last event of the year, which is called 1976. Which is a big après-ski event where people dress up in one piece, fluorescent colors, and just a bit of a throwback to the old-school skiing. And that brings a lot of people, so we thought that would be a great way to just ensure that we could try to break the record.
And so to talk a little more about the logistics, was that something you were centrally involved in? How complicated is it to sort of arrange to have all those people?
It's very complicated, but at the same time, as I said, since we linked it with our 1976 event, it made it a lot more easy. This year we had about 6,000 people who came for the event, so we thought it would be easier to just ensure to have all the participants there at once if we did it at the same time as the event. What was more complicated was having the skis, having to figure out how to put all the shots on the skis, having to link them all together. It took a bit of creativity, a lot of people involved from the community. We had a construction company who helped us a lot, PAM Construction, who were there to drill all the holes in the ski. We know you guys, glued on the shots on the ski or something like that. What we decided to do was drill holes in them, so every year we could just put the shots in the ski directly. It's something that's for the future is going to be good, but it took a good 80 hours of 6 to 8 people just drilling skis. not an easy task.
so how many people, how many skis, how many shots?
All right, so the total, we had 506 skis, which is, I think, 3 more than the record held previously. We had 1,460 people on those skis. So it's roughly a kilometer long or 0.62 miles long, which was our goal to have a kilometer long ski shot.
Wow.
We did it in a slope, so directly on one of our slopes. We did sort of like an N on the slope, trying to fit everybody in. And we used some clips, some kind of like climbing clips, to link them all together with some chains. So all of that was built just so we could easily redo it next year. We try to focus on long term and not just doing one event. As I said, we'd like to hop in on the train and try to participate with Breckenridge and Park City. So we're trying to build something long term to link all the community together.
Now let's get to the really important question. What were the lucky participants drinking?
So we have our local distillery called Cherry River, and it was maple syrup vodka. So their local brewery made us a special batch just for us. Delicious maple syrup vodka. You have to try it. It's delicious. It's vodka. If it's pure, it's a bit hard to drink, but with the maple syrup, it makes it sweet. It's just the perfect drink to have for the ski shot at the end of the year.
Okay. Is there video of the event on social media if our listeners want to get a look at this thing?
Of course, Instagram or Facebook, Mount Orford, so O-R-F-O-R-D, Mount Orford, the Eastern Townships, Facebook, Instagram, you can easily find the video. Check it out. We have a couple of great videos as well of our events going all year round, the 1976. We got some 24-hour skiing as well. A lot of big events, a lot of fun at the mountain for sure.
Well, the question I would normally ask you, I think I already know the answer to. Assuming that both Breckenridge and Park City rise to the bait and try to outdo you, are you coming back next year for another shot?
Oh, for sure, for sure. We want to be there. And in an ideal world, I'll try to be in Utah and in Breckenridge. I'd love to come and see how you guys do it out there. I'd love to see what all the festivities. I know there's a lot going on, not just the ski shot, but a lot of fun around the event as well. Definitely something I would look forward to do and see you guys and say hi for sure.
We're really curious about the taste of maple vodka. I'm not sure we can get it in Utah, but hopefully we'll figure that out. Listen, thanks for spending time with us this
morning. I'll bring some out for sure.
There we go. Thanks for spending time with us this morning. We'll be right back after this.
Thank you.
Deer Valley Resort has dropped the lineup for its summer concert series, starting with a Star-Spangled Classic. The 2025 festival, in partnership with the Utah Symphony and the State Room, Presents will run July 3rd through August 9th. Featured performances with the symphony include The Patriotic Pops, A Salute to John Williams, Disney in Concert, The Music of Journey, and the 1812 Overture. Artists Common and Lindsey Stirling will also grace the mountain stage with the symphony this summer. Pre-sale and ticket packages are available now. Single performance tickets go on sale May 6th. Deer Valley Resort is a financial supporter of KPCW. Utah Governor Spencer Cox says there are a number of arts organizations eager to fill the hole left by the Sundance Film Festival when it relocates to Boulder, Colorado. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports.
During his monthly news conference in Salt Lake City Thursday, Governor Cox reiterated his claim that Utah's conservative politics didn't play a role in Sundance's decision to relocate to a college town in Colorado.
We've been told by the by Sundance leadership, and I trust them, that it was purely a monetary issue for them. They'd been struggling for years, and thought that the Colorado offer was a more generous offer, which is fine.
Utah Senator Dan McKay, who co-sponsored a new state bill banning the use of pride flags in schools and on government property, called for Sundance to leave ahead of its final decision last month. McKay said the festival promoted pornography and themes that deride the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Sundance officials announced they were exploring locations outside of Park City last year because of the high costs in one of Utah's most expensive cities. In recent years, the Sundance Institute has laid off staff, raised ticket prices, and cut venues for its annual event. The Institute's financial records show it took a major hit in 2021, it attributes to the COVID-19 pandemic. Sundance acting CEO Amanda Kelso previously said that Boulder is a place where the festival can build and flourish. Colorado Governor Jared Polis recently signed a bill giving the film festival $34 million in tax credits over 10 years. Utah was offering Sundance more than $12 million in cash and in-kind contributions annually for the festival to remain in the state. But Colorado's financial package was front-loaded with more guaranteed funding. A Sundance report on the 2024 festival found that the event generated a total economic impact of $132 million in Utah, along with supporting over 1,700 local jobs. Cox expressed optimism about the event leaving Thursday. He said it could open the door to new opportunities.
It's been amazing, the repercussions of Sundance leaving. It's been the best thing that could happen. The number of people in lots of different industries in arts and entertainment who are interested in doing something bigger here and better than Sundance is just off the charts. And so, I mean, my phone hasn't stopped ringing.
Cox said he has a list of 50 people in various sectors, including film, music, and technology, who are interested in bringing an event to the state. The governor said more work needs to be done, but he hopes to have something in place by next year. Park City and Salt Lake City will host the Sundance Film Festival in January before the event makes the move to Boulder in 2027. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Eastern Summit County residents want 5 geographic voting districts. That's the bottom line as the county looks to lobby for changes to a state law undoing the at-large county council. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more.
Most residents who spoke at a public hearing in Colville Tuesday support districting the all-at-large Summit County Council. All of Summit County's mayors say they've heard the same and voiced support for 5 districts. Camas Valley resident Katie Canarella shared concerns about how the bill requiring districts passed, but says she still wants them.
Not because Democrat or Republican, it's city versus country. Out on the east side, we are country people. You and Park City are city people. You have different issues. You have tourism. That's your focus primarily. Out there, we just want to maintain our rural lifestyle. Desperately.
Current county leadership has said the local Republican Party advocated for the law requiring districts, House Bill 356. It was passed at the 11th hour during the 2025 general session with no public input. Utah Governor Spencer Cox signed HB 356 with the caveat that he wants to fix unintended consequences in a special session. Wasatch County officials had asked him for a veto because it requires them to redraw their districts too. Tuesday's meeting of the mayors was a chance to talk about what changes Summit County should ask for, including the number of districts, how they're drawn, and what happens to the current council. Most residents spoke just about districts and in favor of the bill as written. Hoytsville Republican Tory Welch initially told KPCW he's in favor of keeping one at-large seat. He changed his tune ahead of the hearing, asking residents on social media to come out in support of all five districts. According to Jimmy May, the Summit County GOP's Park City vice chair, Democrats outnumber Republicans 2-1 in Park City and the Snyderville Basin. In eastern Summit County, Republicans outnumber Democrats 4-1. But western Summit County accounts for 2/3 of the overall population. According to Camas Mayor Matt McCormick, all districts' populations must be within 10% of one another. Here's Colville Mayor Mark Marsh.
Because we don't have a populous number of people that are going to be right here in this little valley, we're going to creep over the edge and we're going to creep over into the west side, so to speak, to get enough population to make it fair.
County Councilmember Canis Hart agreed. He thinks the county might end up with two Snyderville Basin districts, one Park City district, and a South Summit district that may need to include Promontory too. As written, HB 356 says the boundaries will be drawn by a commission of the mayors, one representative from the unincorporated county, and the county clerk, the only member who wouldn't vote. Oakley Mayor Zane Wolstenhume made a motion to recommend an additional unincorporated county representative, but it wasn't seconded. No other changes gained traction. The next time residents can weigh in will be April 23rd at the Sheldon Richens Building in Kimball Junction. And Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. I'm Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, an ongoing theme this morning has been the fact that spring is upon us, notwithstanding what we see out the window. Here to update us on happenings for this spring at the Wasatch Mountain State Park, Wasatch Mountain State Park, let me say that three times, is naturalist Kathy Donald. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning. How are you?
I am doing just fine. So, Kathy, I understand the Celebrate Dark Skies event is coming up this weekend. What's that about?
That is a celebration of dark skies. So, you know, we have a lot of lights in our cities and towns, and we just like to promote that people should turn off their lights. It's not healthy for us or the wildlife, or we can't see the skies at night, which is, you know, they're just absolutely beautiful. So it's a form of light pollution, and it's one of the easiest ways to, or easiest pollutions to get rid of, is to turn off our lights.
And so what will the event consist of?
So we're going to do a presentation about dark skies and turning lights off and light pollution. And then we'll have some activities for kids, adults, and we'll have the University of Utah astronomers that will have clear skies.
I was going to ask you if you would arrange for the cloud cover to be gone tomorrow night for this event.
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So hopefully we'll have clear skies and we'll be able to see some stars. But if not, we still have activities inside that we're doing. So
Kathy, I know there's supposed to be some meteor showers coming up. Are those by any chance going to be visible tomorrow night?
I don't believe so, but I'm not really up on that. Sorry.
Okay. So
that's the one thing I should be up on.
Now, I think is the event sold out, or is there a waiting list?
It is sold out. If people want to call or email me, they can, and I can let them know if they can come.
Okay. And how would they get a hold of you?
My email is Kathy Donnell, so KathyDonnell at utah.gov. They could look up Wasatch Mountain State Park and they could find me there too.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about this sort of transition from winter to spring activities. What are some of the other events and some of the other activities that are going to be available at the park as we move into spring?
Yeah, so spring is a hard time because it's kind of cold and snowy, rainy, muddy. So people just need to be aware that the trails could be muddy, but the trails are open. The campgrounds are starting to open. We just want to make sure we can't make reservations until May 1st. Is when people can start coming in with reservations, but some of them are open. Cottonwood is open, Soldier Hollow is open, and so it's first come, first serve. But we just want to make sure people are disconnecting their hoses from their sites because of freezing, and we have those vacuum breakers on the sites, and those are important to stay on the water just to make sure everybody's healthy. But so the campsites are open, the trails are open, the park is open, the fishing is open. Things like that. We'll have some hikes. People just need to keep looking at our website, Facebook, Instagram, and just, you know, see what we have coming up. But We have the fishing club coming up in June, some hikes, like I said, and some other, the Museum of Fine Arts will be coming to do a couple programs throughout the summer. Just fun things at the park.
Now, do you guys run any camps at the summer?
The only one we run is the fishing club.
Okay.
And that's a 6-week program. And people could email me about that as well.
Yeah. Can you explain what that entails?
It's a 2-hour program a day for 6 weeks on Thursdays and in the morning. Well, we do one in the morning, one in the afternoon. Excuse me. And they learn just about how to tie knots, how to put worms on hooks, how to catch fish, how to hold fish. Just taking care of the environment and, just learning that lifelong skill of fishing. So it's a great program. I have lots of volunteers. I'm also looking for volunteers. So if people are fisher people, they can contact me and let me know if they can help, with kids. Because we have about 40 kids signed up in the morning and about 30 kids in the afternoon.
What are the ages for the participants in that camp?
6 to 12.
Okay. Any other programs that are coming up throughout the course of the summer that you want to highlight while I've got you?
Just some of our hikes. We'll do a geology hike, just to get people out and learning about the environment. And then that Utah Museum of Fine Arts will be a good one. Also, the Hoover Grove will be open throughout the summer, and that's our historical area. And we have an apple orchard up there, so it's always fun to see the apples. Because they're very old. The trees are like 150 years old. So,
and information on all these, and can you register online for all these programs that need registration?
You can email me. Email. Okay. I'm right now.
All
yeah.
Right. And before we go, when's the golf course open?
Oh, it's open, although it might not be open today because of the snow, but it's open.
Okay, so both courses are open?
The lake is open. The silver is open. I'm not sure about the Golden Mountain right now.
All right.
They might still have some snow on them.
All right. And as you say, they're probably not open today. And even if they were, I don't think it'd be much fun.
No, probably not.
All right, Kathy.
Cold.
Thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Park City Mountain announced that it is closing uphill travel for the season earlier than expected because of spring conditions. Spring skiers and riders who were looking to earn their turns had only until 10 o'clock last night, too late. The mountain had said it had to close early so the team can safely move snow to preserve the base area coverage through closing day, Monday, April 21. Deer Valley closes the day before this coming Sunday. Park City Mountain is a financial supporter of KPCW. Heapers joined Midway in implementing rules for e-bike around town. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports the new regulation for riders are effective immediately.
The Heber City Council moved quickly to add e-bike rules to the books after Midway leaders proposed countywide regulations to curb reckless riders. At a meeting Tuesday, Heber City Manager Matt Brower said recent incidents on the trails have made clear the need for new rules.
About 2 weeks ago, there was, as I understand it, a juvenile who was using an e-motorcycle on a backcountry soft surface trail, damaging the trail. He came across a volunteer. The young juvenile was belligerent, called his father, who was equally belligerent, and that's why this policy is before you tonight. We recognize Heber City currently does not have a policy, and we are in need of one.
The e-bike ordinance allows people to use their e-bikes or e-scooters on paved paths and sidewalks in Heber, and it allows the least powerful kind of e-bike, known as Class 1, on backcountry trails. City engineer Russ Funk asked why he couldn't bring a Class 2 e-bike, which is a little more powerful than Class 1 due to a throttle, on soft surface trails. Tori Broughton, a planning commissioner who also runs Trek Bike on Heber's Main Street, said the rule helps protect trails. More powerful bikes tend to spin out more easily and damage the single track.
Once you add a throttle, that's when you start to get into trail degradation. I think that the lack of throttle is actually what has helped e-bikes gain access to trails.
In neighboring Summit County, no e-bikes are allowed on soft surface trails. Within Park City limits, only riders 65 and older or who have a mobility disability can use e-bikes on the single track. Heber's rules stipulate that any violation of the new e-bike ordinance will be a Class B misdemeanor, which carries penalties of up to $1,000 in fines or up to 6 months in jail. Park City's regulations list the violation as an infraction, punishable by up to $750 in fines. City Attorney Jeremy Cook said he recommended adding some guidelines about riding prudently.
You should yield to pedestrians. You cannot operate them in a negligent manner.
The ordinance also requires e-bikers to stay within a reasonable and prudent speed, but does not specify a speed limit. That's on par with Midway's new rules, but different from Summit County's across-the-board 15-mile-per-hour limit. Wasatch County has not yet discussed adding e-bike rules for unincorporated areas of the county. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Eight Utahns made Forbes' 2025 list of billionaires. KPCW's Christine Weller reports that one is a Park City local.
Forbes reports there are over 3,000 billionaires in the world, worth $16.1 trillion in total, up almost $2 trillion from last year. The U.S. boasts the four richest people in the world: Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, and Larry Ellison. Axios Salt Lake City reports eight Utahns also made the billionaire list. Larry H. Miller co-owner Gail Miller remains the state's richest person with an estimated worth of $4.4 billion, up from $3.9 billion in 2024. Cloudflare co-founder and CEO Matthew Prince is close behind. The park record owner has an estimated net worth of $4.2 billion, up from last year's $3.4 billion. Prince co-founded the web infrastructure and security company in 2009 and owns about 8% of it. He's been recently caught up in a legal dispute over his plans to build a home on Park City's Treasure Hill. The project was put on hold last year as Prince and his neighbor, Old Town resident Eric Herman, are involved in a 3rd District Court lawsuit over the CEO's home plans. Ryan Smith, Qualtrics founder and owner of the Utah Jazz and the Utah Hockey Club, ranks 3rd in Utah's billionaire lineup. He has an estimated worth of $2.6 billion. Smith's brother Jared and father Scott are next on the list, worth $1.4 billion and $1.2 billion respectively. Worth $1 billion each, iFit co-founder Scott Watterson and PAX Group co-founders Mark Hanock and Jason Murray conclude Utah's billionaire list. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
A number of developers have submitted bids to finalize the Park City project, once referred to as a future arts and culture district. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has more on the second round of proposals for Bonanza Park.
Park City wants to develop 5 acres at the intersection of Bonanza Drive and Kearns Boulevard into a new district with housing, commercial space, and a new home for the Kimball Arts Center. In February, the Park City Council put out a new request for development bids. The council revised its initial proposal to include a $30 million funding commitment. Previously, the city had not specified how much it would contribute. Park City Manager Matt Dias told KPCW that a committee of residents, city staff, and other stakeholders would evaluate development proposals after the submission deadline earlier this month.
I think we're at an exciting moment, and I'm really fingers and toes crossed that we'll have a quality developer to move forward with once and for all.
The committee will be scoring the proposals based on several criteria, including past work, alignment with the city's vision, and total cost, among other variables. The Park City Council will interview the leading developers in a public meeting once the committee selects its top two proposals. Dias said he hopes to do final interviews in May. In a recent State of Park City address, Mayor Nan Worrell challenged the city council to pick a developer for the 5-acre project by June 1st. The site in the Bonanza Park neighborhood has an extensive history. Park City purchased the property for $19 million in 2017, planning to build an arts and culture district with the Kimball Arts Center and Sundance Institute as core tenants. The Bonanza Park concept evolved to also include housing, parking, and a transit center, but the project was put on hold when costs topped $100 million. In 2024, Park City hit the reset button by collecting public input through online surveys and open houses. That feedback helped revise the proposal to reflect public support for a mixed-use area with retail, art, and open space. Sundance has not been involved in the recent phase of planning for the property. The nonprofit is relocating its annual film festival to Boulder, Colorado in 2027. Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of KPCW. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Wasatch County is distributing almost $300,000 in grants to improve the community's trails and support the arts. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has details on the spring round of funding.
The grants come from the Trails Arts and Parks, or TAP tax revenue, a 0.1% sales tax approved by voters in 2022. For the spring grant cycle, the TAP board recommended funding 22 projects, and the Wasatch County Council approved its recommendations Wednesday. Board Chair Elise Overly told the council interest in the grants has soared.
We were able to complete our first grant cycle back in 24. We approved those recommendations together and allocated just over $285,000 for 13 projects. This next cycle doubled in applicants, so that was exciting.
Of the 27 applications, most were for arts projects. The TAP board recommended supporting projects including the Wasatch Back Art Festival, community concert dance and line dancing programs, audio equipment for the Midway Playhouse, and a mural of salmon at the Strawberry Reservoir Visitor Center. For trails projects, the Wasatch Trails Foundation was awarded funding for a backcountry trail maintenance crew. The TAP board also recommended funding a ridge trail at Soldier Hollow. In total, the county's spring grants are worth over $298,000. For a full list of funded projects, visit kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Coming up Monday on Mountain Money, we're going to be talking with author Stephen Witt. He wrote The Thinking Machine. It's a biography of the longstanding CEO and founder of NVIDIA. Should be a really interesting chat. I hope you'll join us.